This is an ABC podcast.
This is Pacific Beach on ABC Radio Australia. Today, social media users in Papua New Guinea have been left shocked as a video allegedly showing police officers violently attacking three men goes viral. It appears to be another case of police brutality in the country. We're going to bring you the latest on that story in just a moment. Also coming up, world scientists declare that the world is facing a climate emergency and that governments are failing to address the crisis.
We are calling for transformative change by humanity.
And more on that story and much more coming up here on Pacific Beach. Good morning, I'm Catherine Grau. Well, first this morning, police in PNG have launched an investigation after a video surfaced on social media yesterday showing police officers beating three men. It's triggered community outrage. The Acting Police Commissioner, David Manning, has vowed to bring justice for the victims, while the Police Minister has told the ABC that the officers have been identified and suspended. But many community members say that that doesn't seem to be going far enough. With this just the latest case of alleged police brutality, some people now say they want a complete overhaul of the policing system. A reporter, Jordan Fennell, has been keeping a close eye on this story and following the developments. Jordan, what can you tell us firstly about this video?
The video appears to have been shot from across the street from where the incident happened. It's a really grainy video, but you see three men lying on the ground. They're wearing shorts and t-shirts. And then there are two other men in blue shirts, which appear to have police insignia on the shoulders. And they're also wearing long pants and holding what appear to be guns. They hit the men on the ground with the butt of their guns. They also yell at them, kick them and stomp on them. This is all happening near a white car that does not have police signage on it and is unclear who it belongs to. At various points in the video, the men in the blue shirts open the car doors and look around through the car. Then about a third of the way through the video, another car pulls up without police insignia and a new group of men get out. These men are wearing darker clothes and what appear to be boots. They begin assaulting the men on the ground as well. They hit the first car with bats and sticks, breaking the back window, and then they hit the men. The video lasts for 18 minutes, and the men are beaten throughout the entire thing.
Well, what have police said about the video, Jordan?
Well, the police have claimed that it is their officers from the Royal Papua New Guinea Constabulary who are shown beating the men on the ground. The Acting Police Commissioner, David Manning, has made a statement saying that the video angered him and he vowed to investigate and bring those responsible to justice. He also said that the video showed a clear case of excessive use of force as the men on the ground did not resist but continued to be assaulted by police.
And we understand, Jordan, the police minister has told the ABC that the officers have now been identified. They've been suspended, but we haven't got any more details than that yet. What about the community reaction then? Because this is certainly not the first time we've seen allegations that police have been extremely excessive with their use of force in PNG. There were reports and increasingly video evidence that surfaces, it seems, every few months.
Yeah, there's been a huge outcry from community members. The video has gone viral on social media and many are calling for the police to do something about this. I spoke with Port Moresby resident Stan Nilian, who watched the video on Monday night, and he says he wants to see a complete overhaul of the policing system.
Obviously, it was very gruesome and overly excessive. What I think should be done is that the police should control how they act, because they are there to enforce the law. You know, the law is for everybody. We have our rights. The police should work within the boundaries or the code of conduct. You know, there's a way to apprehend a criminal. There's no need for excessive violence. You know, if the person has been apprehended, handcuff them and take them to the jail. You know, if you're assaulting them physically and then you're taking them to the jail, it's like double punishment.
That is Stan Knillian. He's a Port Moresby resident speaking there with our reporter, Jordan Fennell. Well, staying with the issue of human rights, because later today, the human rights record of Fiji will be going under the microscope on the other side of the world in Geneva in front of the UN Human Rights Council. It's part of a periodic review that all 193 UN member states take part in. It's the third examination of Fiji's record since the year 2008. Now, some human rights watchers think that it's going to be a solemn affair for Fiji's government, with accusations that the country's media is still suppressed, that women and minority groups experience high levels of harassment, and also allegations that security forces in the country do use torture. Now, the UN itself also isn't escaping any criticism either, and with some suggesting there's a danger that its reviews may just amount to little more than a slap on the wrist. Our reporter Nick Fogarty's been taking a look at what we can expect and the significance of the review. Beginning firstly, Nick, can you talk us through, though, what actually happens at these reviews?
So essentially each state under review, in this case Fiji, with a delegation led by Chief Justice Kamal Kumar, presents their own report to the UN where they highlight recent developments in human rights in their country and the steps they've taken to implement the recommendations made after previous reviews, which for Fiji were in 2014 and 2010. And it should be noted this report includes contributions from NGOs. Three other nations are appointed as rapporteurs to advise and report on whatever Fiji puts forward, and offer more recommendations on where they can improve.
Now, Nick, Fiji's report's actually already publicly available, so we've been able to take a look at it. How does its own self-assessment of the current human rights situation match up to what you've been hearing from some people who watch human rights in Fiji very closely?
Well, Fiji's come under sustained criticism from human rights activists for quite a few years now, although it's certainly not alone there among Pacific Island nations or indeed Australia. I spoke to Rashika Dio, who's a Fijian human rights activist and former researcher with the human rights group Amnesty International, and she mentions several examples where she claims that the reality on the ground doesn't match up to what's in Fiji's own report to the UN. For example, Fiji's report states that no human rights defenders there have been harassed since the last state report in 2014, but Rashika Dio claims this is false. This is what she had to say.
So if they do not understand who human rights defenders are, and they are, you know, making these assertions of no human rights defenders harassed since the last UPR reporting, it's very worrying because that's not been the case. And in fact, we also had, you know, the media organization, media that is usually perceived to be critical of the government and its policies and governance structures, are targeted and charged with sedition and related charges.
That's Fijian human rights activist Rashika Dio. And some of the other points that will be raised at the hearing, which other nations have actually submitted already, include what measures does the government take to prevent acts of torture and ill treatment by prison officers? What measures will the government take to eliminate discrimination against lesbian, bisexual and transgender women? And what steps is the government taking to tackle forced labour, modern slavery and human trafficking? And Fiji's government will, of course, have a chance to respond to these questions and any specific allegations during the review meeting.
Now, Nick, the UN is certainly very large, somewhat bureaucratic. It has faced criticism itself for being slow and ineffective at times. So can it actually wield much real power in making countries like Fiji conform to any recommendations that will be made?
Well, there is often debate over how effectively the UN member states can actually enforce their own rulings. The UN General Assembly can suspend the rights and privileges of any of the 47 Human Rights Council members if it decides they've committed gross human rights violations. But what flow-on effect that has for the citizens who are having their rights violated is less clear. And bear in mind that last year Fiji was the first Pacific Island nation to be elected to the Human Rights Council. Now, the three nations acting as rapporteurs at Fiji's review are Rwanda, Saudi Arabia and Brazil, who've all faced their own human rights issues. Chad Clay is a co-founder of Human Rights Measurement Initiative, who've done a lot of work collecting data in Fiji, and I asked him for his thoughts on the effectiveness of the UN as a human rights enforcer.
I think it's generally representative of the problem with a sole reliance on the United Nations for understanding countries' human rights practices. The United Nations will probably never be capable of producing objective, comparable data on human rights because the members of the United Nations are the governments themselves that are obligated by international human rights law. So in a lot of ways, asking them to produce data on their respect for human rights is a lot like asking any person to readily report any time they violated the law, which if you were going to base data on that, you'd probably be underestimating the number of violations of the law. So it's indicative of that problem and that process.
That is Chad Clay. He's the co-founder of the Human Rights Measurement Initiative, our reporter Nick Fogarty.
You're listening to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
More than 11,000 scientists from around the world have put their names to a statement out today declaring a climate emergency and calling on world leaders to make urgent changes to prevent the worst effects of climate change, as Michael Tsledzak reports.
The UK government has declared a climate and environment emergency.
As climate change bites, governments are declaring emergencies.
Scotland has declared a global climate emergency.
The idea has sparked debate in Australia too.
The world now, Mr Deputy Speaker, is facing a climate emergency.
A claim now backed by thousands of scientists. In the journal Bioscience, 11,263 scientists have put their names to a paper entitled World Scientists' Warning of a Climate Emergency. Professor William Ripple, an ecologist from Oregon State University, organised the warning.
There are many cities in the world that have declared climate emergencies. Our statement about a climate emergency might help give backing to policymakers that want to do the same.
It includes scientists from institutions Australians will be familiar with, like the CSIRO and Oxford University, as well as others in Estonia, Zimbabwe and Uruguay. All up, scientists from 153 countries have put their name to the paper. Is this science or is it activism?
The key here is that it's evidence-based and science-based.
Does the science say that we are in a climate emergency?
Well, that's a judgment call. The consensus of our group is, yes, we are in one.
The scientists point to 29 vital signs, 15 measures of human impacts that affect the climate, like forest cover and livestock populations, as well as 14 climatic responses, like sea level change and ocean acidity. Dr. Thomas Newsom, an ecologist at the University of Sydney, is another of the lead authors on the paper. He says these indicators should become part of the public discussion, broadening the discussion beyond just greenhouse gas concentrations and temperature changes.
Governments at their own country level should actually be reporting this data back to the public so that we can track progress over time.
The scientists also call for six actions, including shifting to renewable energy and moving to plant-based diets.
We are calling for transformative change by humanity.
A group called the Alliance of World Scientists organised the declaration. It's not their first warning.
So in 2017, we published the World Scientists Warning to Humanity. But over the last 2 years, the news and the science on climate change has been getting more severe, and the climate has been changing faster than most predicted. So what we felt the need to do now is put out a very specific warning with vital signs on a climate emergency.
It is Professor William Ripple. He's from Oregon State University. That report from Michael Tsledzak. Well, that warning comes as the US government has formally given notice to the United Nations that it is pulling out of the Paris Climate Agreement. It's an announcement that hasn't surprised too many people, as the President Donald Trump announced some time ago that he intended to do so. Reporter Girish Shalani has taken a look at what lies ahead now for the Paris Accord and the possible impacts of the US's decision.
It's all about timing for the US president, who's long rejected the idea of global warming. And if it all works out for Donald Trump, the United States will formally exit the Paris Agreement the day after the 2020 presidential elections.
The United States will withdraw from the Paris Climate Accord, but begin negotiations to re-enter either the Paris Accord or in really entirely new transaction on terms that are fair to the United States, its businesses, its workers, its people, its taxpayers.
The Paris climate deal brought together all nations of the world to be part of a single agreement to tackle climate change for the first time in history. The key commitment, among others, was for those countries to limit global temperature rise to below 2 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels this century and pursue efforts to make that figure 1.5%. The Obama administration signed up in 2015, but Donald Trump declared he would withdraw 2 years later, saying it would hurt the U.S. economy and favor other major emitters like China. But President Trump is still leaving the door open.
So we're getting out, but we will start to negotiate and we will see if we can make a deal that's fair. And if we can, that's great. And if we can't, that's fine.
So will the withdrawal have a significant impact? The likely answer is yes. And that's because the United States has been the biggest historical emitter of carbon. It currently accounts for around 15% of CO2 emissions. So there's no doubt a US withdrawal will make it more difficult for that 2% figure to be achieved. And dozens of countries, including many in the Pacific, which are on the front lines of rising sea levels, are trying to achieve an even more ambitious goal to reach net zero emissions by 2050. But they represent only about 11% of the world's climate footprint and exclude the biggest emitters, China, the US and India. So for now, at least, the US will be the world's only non-signatory of the Paris Agreement, although 10 other countries are yet to ratify, among them Turkey, Iran and Iraq.
That's Girish Salani reporting there. Well, they often say change takes time. So is it actually possible to significantly alter the culture of a business in just 2 years? Well, new research out from Solomon Islands has found that a program that's been rolled out in 15 of the country's largest companies has seen some pretty dramatic changes in just 2 years, helping to make the workplaces safer, especially for women. Now, those behind the initiative that's known as Waka Mary say that having more women in leadership positions is largely the reason why.
In terms of confidence and being, you know, step out and leading the team, I should say. Being a Solomon Island national myself in a senior level, I don't have the basic...
Lynn Faroto is a senior bank manager in Solomon Islands, one of the few females working at such a level.
But I have been attending like in-house training, but it doesn't broaden my knowledge in terms of becoming, you know, a leader or what are the leadership skills that are there.
The lack of confidence and adequate skills amongst working women in Solomon Islands is a common story. It's something similar to what Atanasi Atta has seen too during various times in her career.
Women are defaulting to readily, you know, being the coffee makers, the tea, the food servers at big significant meetings. You look at the social and the whole structure behind it.
She's the Chief Executive Officer of the Solomon Islands Chamber of Commerce, which is one of the partners on the Waka Mary program. It means she works.
That's the value of this program. Just that role modelling, having 15 big companies put their hand up and being willing to do that.
Those 15 companies have more than 6,000 employees between them. 2 years before the Waka Mary program began, they found that 25% of the female workers felt unsafe at work. Amy Lewinstra from the IFC, that's the International Finance Corporation, which has also led the program, explains some of the reasons why.
We know overall in Solomon Islands, there is considerably fewer women in formal work than there are men. And so most all women are working in places where they're dominated by men, not just because there's more men than women in most of the workplaces, but also the men are in leadership positions. And for the most part, men are also in certain technical roles that tend to pay better and in positions just on the whole that have a bit more power. So that can be part of it. There's also, I mean, of course, a history here in Solomon Islands of the tensions and some of that post-conflict kind of culture and issues play out in the workplace. And most importantly, 2 out of every 3 women in Solomon Islands is likely to have been affected directly by violence in her lifetime. So all of those things, you know, they play out at workplaces as much as they play out in communities.
But in new research, they've found the situation has improved dramatically.
To be honest, I was surprised. I mean, delighted, of course, but really surprised that you could see such a cultural shift in just 2 years of work.
The key, both Amy Lewinstra and Atanasi Atta believe, has been the multifaceted approach of the Waka Mary program.
Working at those different levels, I can see now why this finding. Yeah, so it's not really a surprise, but it's good. It's a very positive outcome.
Dozens of women have been put through leadership training that's seen 80% of them promoted or given broader responsibilities in their current jobs.
The leadership training was one of the most, I think, transformational, because you're unleashing the creativity and the confidence of women that previously really didn't have that confidence or that ability to speak out, or no one was listening and they didn't think they could speak.
Companies have also introduced things like anti-bullying and domestic violence policies. And most have also trained a select number of staff, so they're better equipped to deal with survivors of domestic violence they may come across in the workplace. They're all changes that IFC's Amy Lewinstra says are also benefiting the male employees.
We talk about bullying a lot, and that often affects more men than women. And what we're talking about is just being respectful and supportive of employees, whether they're men or women.
It's Amy Lewinstra from the International Finance Corporation. Well, the use of the Pacific Ocean as a drug supply route for producers in South America to try and reach their markets in countries like Australia and New Zealand has been highlighted a lot over the past year, with the discovery of cocaine and heroin in various places from PNG to Fiji and also Solomon Islands. And it's a topic that's back in the headlines. Earlier this week, police in Fiji arrested four men. It's alleged they were trying to export cocaine to Australia. Meanwhile, in Solomon Islands, the discovery of an abandoned dinghy on a remote island loaded with hundreds of packages of cannabis has sparked concerns there that there may be a transnational drugs network in operation. Evan Wasuka has been taking a look. And Evan, what exactly has happened in Solomon Islands?
Well, Catherine, towards the end of last week, an aluminium dinghy drifted ashore on Ulawa Island in the eastern part of the Solomon Islands. Now, the boat was loaded with packages of what locals say looked like marijuana. In fact, hundreds of these packages were stacked into the walling of the boat. Police had carried out a preliminary test on the substance, which they've identified as marijuana. Now, police say it was apparent that the boat had drifted for some time, and when it came ashore, it was covered in seaweed and shells. Now, on the side of the boat, it had the name Yelena, but its origins continue to be a mystery. Local media report that there were bullet holes on the side of the boat, and there was also white powder substance on the boat itself. I spoke to the acting police commissioner, crime, Ian Vevaso, who says police are yet to carry out tests on the bottle of white substance they found on the boat. ACP Vevaso say police are pretty certain that the boat came from outside of Solomon Islands waters.
Assessment of this, we're still looking into assessing and further causing inquiries into this large amount of drugs that comes into our shores. First, we believe that these drugs or this boat comes from abroad through our borders. So this might be possibly a gang consignment. And we believe it is not from Solomon Islands. It comes from abroad and through our borders. And so that's exactly what we think. We think it may have been floating or could have been drifted from somewhere out of, from our border, and it comes through our border, or possibly it comes through our border through other means.
Now, Evan, the other drug cases we've seen in the Pacific have been of much harder drugs, things like cocaine and heroin. Now, this one in Solomon Islands was marijuana. It's a lower class of drug. Why do police still think that it's a transnational case rather than a domestic one? And what might the next step be for police investigating this case?
Well, Catherine, there's a number of reasons why police seem to think that this is more of a transnational criminal activity rather than a local domestic one. For example, the amount of drugs involved are quite large, and the way it was all packed and packaged away, which is unlike what's been seen locally. And then there's, of course, the boat this turned up in. This type of boat is simply not the type that's used in the Solomon Islands, and it's not one that's commonly seen around the waters there. Because this looks like an incident that's gone beyond Solomon Islands' borders, they'll be seeking help from international partners like the Australian Federal Police and Interpol to find out more what happened about this mystery boat, its origins, and where it was going to.
Through our bilateral arrangements and even through our police-to-police agreements and even with Interpol to support us into further inquiring into this drug issue.
It is the Solomon Islands Acting Police Commissioner of Crime, Ian Vivaso, speaking with our reporter, Evan Wasuka. That is all for Pacific Beat this morning. I'm Catherine Grau. Thanks so much for your company this morning. You have a great day.